diagnosed with a concussion. It left his ability to play again in the series in doubt because he had to enter the league's concussion protocol, which meant his return time was undetermined and based on an independent doctor's review. It was just another problem. So was Irving. He was subpar in games 1 and 2, shooting just 12 of 36 and repeatedly getting beaten on the defensive end. The Warriors deployed defensive strategies aimed at isolating Irving, switching on pick and rolls to limit his ability to attack. The result was some of Irving's bad habits returning, specifically his tendency to hold the ball and not pass. He didn't have an assist until the fourth quarter of Game 2, opening up some old wounds. Irving was polarizing in this way. His greatness as a player who could create his own shot was unquestioned, but his reliance on it sometimes irritated his teammates. It had gotten under James's skin in the first games they'd played together. When he was playing this way, his defensive issues felt more pronounced, even with all the fine performances he turned in along the way to the finals. The magnifying glass of June made it harder on him. Before the series, a think tank made up of Harvard students called the Harvard College Sports Analysis Collective released a paper titled "A Modest Proposal, Bench Kyrie Irving." The argument was his offense, as great as the highlights looked, wasn't statistically worth his ball hogging and his lack of defense. By its nature, it was overly academic and meant to be shocking, but it did represent a way of thinking that Irving wasn't always a positive influence. James, frustrated by the losses, didn't mention Irving by name, but did make it clear he didn't think everyone was on the same page. He even seemed to indirectly hint at what the Harvard analysts suggested, that Irving might need to be benched at times against Golden State. If guys are out there not following the game plan, then coach has to sub them out, and other guys have to come in and do what he wants to do, James said. If guys aren't competing, then Coach Lou can make a decision at that point. Lou didn't go to Harvard. He went to Nebraska, and while he studied the numbers and could quote detailed analytics off the top of his head when needed, he was also a former player who took part in finals games. He understood the pressure, and he understood the need for support. He had been in Irving's corner since those early days in 2014, when he helped convince him to sign a contract extension based on promises and trust, even though James wasn't in the picture and the Cavs had done nothing but lose. Lou did go to Irving to talk, but he didn't tell him to pass more. He told him to attack more. He wanted Irving to shoot. He didn't care if he didn't pass. He just didn't want Irving to wait 15 seconds before making the decision. Lou told Irving to block out the noise and to be himself, and that was not a guy who was frozen with indecision. Perhaps he couldn't shut down Curry on defense. No one in the world could on some nights. But Lou told Irving no one on the Warriors could stop him either. "No one can stop you one-on-one when you have the ball," Lou told him. Game 3 was back in Cleveland and was vitally important to the Cavs. The doctors didn't clear Love to play. He was angry when he found out the morning of the game, believing he was symptom-free. But he hadn't met all the requirements, and it wasn't in the team's hands. The Cavs would have to play without him. Lou decided to insert Richard Jefferson in his place, to play with an ultra-small lineup to attempt to match the Warriors' versatility. As the crowd roared just before tip-off, James gathered the team outside the locker room. "Look at the man in front of you," James said. "Do your job. Follow my lead and do your job." Whether it was Handy's speech, Lou's pep talk with Irving, the skin growing back on Smith's hand, or the comfort of being at home, the Cavs looked like a different team. They looked like the team that had won their first 10 playoff games. James played loose and with force, putting up 32 points, 11 rebounds, and 6 assists. Irving was back to playing with speed and making quick decisions, forcing the Warriors to their heels as he racked up 30 points. Smith made 5 three-pointers. Jefferson played well in place of Love, leading some to wonder if the lineup switch should remain permanent. Lou dusted off Timofey Mozgov, who'd barely played after the trade to get Channing Frye, and Mozgov leveled Klay Thompson with a screen, kneeing him in the thigh. Thompson hobbled to the locker room and later called it a dirty play. Curry had another meek showing and failed to score 20 points for the third straight game, the first time that had happened in his playoff career. Now it was his turn to face questions as he appeared to lack acceleration and ability to get open that had been the cornerstone of his MVP season. Just how much his wounded knee was bothering him became an issue. In the second half, after a whistle had stopped play, Curry grabbed the ball and went to harmlessly lay it in the basket as officials reported the foul. James saw it and leapt in the way, reaching up and blocking the practice shot. "I didn't want him to see the ball go in," James said, "whether it's after the whistle or not." The Cavs ended up winning by 30, the most lopsided loss the Warriors had absorbed all season. It had been a year since the Cavs tasted a win over Golden State, and it was cathartic, even if they still trailed in the series and remained a heavy underdog. They came out and played like a team with a sense of desperation, like their season was on the line, Green said. "We came out and played like everything was peaches and cream." Love came out of the locker room to greet his teammates in the hallway as they arrived after the final horn. They embraced him. He'd felt sick that he couldn't play in what was the biggest game of the season. When they got inside, Love was handed a piece of the puzzle and honored by placing the 13th golden peg into its place. Just 3 spots were left to be filled. Chapter 18. 3-1 lead. "You're a bitch." The words from Draymond Green froze LeBron James. Green had said far worse to James over the course of the finals, and James had used worse language himself to Green and his teammates. But as the Chicago Bulls' Joakim Noah had learned by surprise a year earlier, that was a trigger word for James in the heat of a game. "I'm a father of 3 and a man," James said back to Green in the midst of live play, the ball in Andre Iguodala's hands just a few feet away. "You're still a bitch," Green spat back. Within seconds, Green and James were tangled with each other. Danny Crawford, one of the NBA's most veteran and respected officials, stepped in and called a foul on each man, hoping to defuse the situation. "I'm all cool with competition. I'm all fine with that. But some of the words that came out of his mouth were overboard," James said. "I felt like at that point in time, it was a little bit outside of basketball." There were 3 minutes left in Game 4, and it was essentially decided. The Warriors had stormed back, Steph Curry looking like his MVP self and nailing 8 three-pointers on his way to 38 points as he repeatedly silenced the Cleveland crowd. The Warriors were up 10 and about to go up 3-1 in the series heading home, their second consecutive title over the Cavs in a death grip. But something had just happened that would change the course of the series, something that would become one of the more controversial plays in NBA history. It happened so fast that Crawford had missed it, even though it was right in front of him. James was more obsessed with Green's choice of words. Green thought he was acting in self-defense. James and Green had started out shoving as Green set a pick for Curry. Green pushed James and then James pushed back, Green falling over in an effort to get officials to call a foul. The act miffed James, although he was often guilty of such flopping antics himself. Then he stepped over the top of Green. This is where opinions diverge. James said he was trying to get back into the play, and that was the fastest route. Green and his teammates believed James was stepping over him in a demeaning way. The Warriors players were more coarse in their description. They felt James was almost being primal in dragging his lower body over Green's head. Green's response was also as old as time. He swung his arm up and hit James between the legs. The entire ordeal only took a second in real time, but Green had been disciplined by the league earlier in the playoffs for kicking Thunder center Steven Adams in the groin on a play the Thunder howled as suspension-worthy, while Green insisted it was only the result of body momentum. He'd also tripped a Thunder player and appeared to intentionally strike Adams with a blow to his injured hand. The result was a list of warning penalties by the league. James was in the middle of an uneven performance. As usual, his statistics were sensational. 25 points, 13 rebounds, 9 assists, 2 steals, and 3 blocks. But he committed 7 turnovers, which was crushing against the Warriors' high-speed attack. Worse, he and Irving were in their isolation mode again. Irving had 34 points, which was good, but when they played independent of each other instead of together, it worked to the Warriors' advantage, because the Cavs became easier to defend as a whole. James and Irving took 33 of the team's 38 shots in the second half, and the Warriors outscored them by 16 points. Love came back from the concussion, and Lou brought him off the bench, but he wasn't able to be a difference maker. James was frustrated at the officials. He was convinced the Warriors were getting away with roughhousing him. He played 46 minutes and only ended up drawing 2 shooting fouls. And of course, there was the scoreboard, which read 108-97 at the end. The Cavs' locker room was silent. James sat at his locker, his knees in ice, and he quietly picked at a plate of chicken and rice. He was on the verge of falling to 2-5 in his career in the finals, a number he knew could be used to horsewhip his legacy for the rest of his life. He was playing at a high level, just as he'd done the previous 2 finals that he also lost. As he picked at his meal, a reporter walked up to him with a cell phone. On it was the footage of his run-in with Green. In slow motion, Green's swing into his groin was plain to see. James watched it once, twice, and then a third time before handing the phone back. "Yeah," he said, "but they won't do anything." In an office next door, the parties weren't so calm. David Griffin and Ty Lue were in a debate about whether to make the officiating an issue in the post-game press conference. Commenting on officiating during the playoffs is as old as the postseason itself, and there's a reason teams do it. Though it almost always triggers a fine from the league, 2 of the Cavs' opponents had already been slapped with one in the playoffs, it also sometimes works. Griffin and Lue, down 3-1, decided there was nothing left to lose. "LeBron never gets calls," Lue said. "I mean, he attacks. He's one of the guys that attacks the paint every single play, and he doesn't get a fair whistle all the time because of his strength and because of his power and guys bounce off of him. But those are still fouls, and we weren't able to get them." "It's been like that all year," James said. "I'm getting hit, but the refs are not seeing it that way." Pressed further, he cut off the topic. "I'm going to save my $25,000, okay?" James, who is immensely wealthy, is sometimes funny about money. He owns a fleet of cars from classics to Ferraris to high-end luxury cars to a specially outfitted van. He flies liberally on private jets. But after getting to know Warren Buffett in 2006, he even spent a day with him at Buffett's headquarters in Omaha. He took Buffett's advice to save seriously. He went through a phase where he didn't even want to pay a copay to see a doctor who was outside the network of the Cavs insurance plan. He didn't like to have the feeling he was wasting money. The next day, Lou got hit with a $25,000 fine. James did not. Lou had another message beyond the officiating. The situation was dire. No team had ever come back from being down 3-1 in the finals. It had happened 33 times in history, and only 3 teams had ever even forced a Game 7. And that hadn't happened for half a century. The Warriors hadn't lost 3 games in a row in nearly 3 years. 2 of the final 3 games would be in Oakland, where the Warriors were 50-3 that season, and 98-6 over the previous 2 seasons. "If you don't think we can win, don't get on the plane," Lou told his team before they left for the night. "We've got to come back anyway, so we might as well come back and play Game 6. Late in the night, after James had gone home and stewed about the outcome of the game with his wife, he pulled out his phone and opened the Cavs' group text and composed a message. "No matter how we got to this point, we're here now," James wrote. "We have to go to Golden State for Game 5, and we have to come home anyway, so why not come home and play a game six? Let it go, play hard, be focused, follow my lead, and I'll make sure you get home for a game six. The next morning, just a few hours later, James was the first person into work at the team practice facility. The outlook was indeed bleak, but he was not giving up. James wasn't the only one with such a feeling. The more Griffin thought about it, the more he grew amused. It got to the point where he was laughing to himself. Of course the team was down 3-1, he thought. They had to be down. His team never did anything the easy way. It was always about coming to the brink of disaster. This wasn't a crisis, Griffin decided. Not at all. This was his team playing their game. Maybe Griffin was punch drunk from stress and pressure. He'd built a wildly expensive roster, and if it failed again, he'd get a big dose of blame. He was the one who had fired David Blatt, who had put together a game plan that had pushed the Warriors in the finals the year before with way less firepower than they had now. But Griffin didn't see it that way at all. In his 20-plus seasons working in the NBA, he'd rarely felt a clarity like this. And he felt he had to share it. With his emotions flowing, he composed an email that he didn't just send to the team and coaches. He sent to the entire company, the sales department, the marketing department, the vice presidents, the secretaries, the security guards. Griff called me and said, "I'm going to send an email to the entire company. How do I do it?" And I said, "Why? What the hell are you doing?" said Tad Carper, the Cavs' senior vice president of communications. At that point, his intensity level was like somebody who had this awakening. Griffin sent the email. It read, "Family, if you are like me, and sadly for all of you, many of you are more like me than you'd care to admit, you felt a little like a bomb went off late into last night, and maybe even this morning. Needless to say, we are all disappointed that we didn't hold serve at home. However, I have a few thoughts to share with you that I think might make the wait for our Game 5 victory in Oakland and our ultimate triumph in an epic Game 7 a little more reality than dream. Consider the two seasons we have spent together and think about all these things that make us historically special. We enter last season the prohibitive Vegas favorite to win the NBA title. Our starting center tears his Achilles 26 games into the season. Our MVP focal point misses 2 weeks with a back injury. We become the first team in NBA history to enter as NBA title favorites to start a season with a losing record through 39 games. Actually, went 19-20. We trade one player for three, get our MVP back, and go an NBA best 32-7 over the next 39 games. During this stretch, we ranked first in the NBA in winning percentage, 821, first in scoring differential, 10.6, and first in three-pointers made per game, 11.8. We sweep our first-round opponent and in Game 4 lose our starting power forward for the remainder of the playoffs and most of the next 6 months. We win the next round against Chicago despite starting down 2-1 while our starting point guard is battling knee issues. He only plays 12 minutes in the Game 6 win. We win one game because our assistant coaches save our head coach from calling a timeout we didn't actually have. That would have resulted in a technical foul and the ball to Chicago in a tie game. Never seen that before either. We then sweep a 60-win team and the number one seed in the East while Kyrie misses games 2 and 3 with the knee issue. We move on to the NBA Finals. LeBron and James Jones appear in their fifth straight NBA Finals. We drop Game 1 and lose Kyrie for the remainder of the playoffs. We are now down 2 All-Stars. So what do? We win the next 2 games to take a 2-1 lead over this same Warriors team. Our new starting point guard, Dele, has to be taken to the hospital on a stretcher after the Game 3 win because we can't hydrate him fast enough to combat his muscles that are shutting down from exhaustion. The Warriors discover their best lineup as a desperation move to save their finals, because we had beaten the piss out of them physically. Wounded and battered, we eventually succumb, but everyone is ready to run it back healthy. Off-season. Everyone returns. We keep the band intact. A group that went 34-3 in the last 37 games that LeBron, Kevin, and Kyrie all play in. Ownership spends the second most money in NBA history to achieve this. This season, we start training camp without Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving, and Iman Shumpert, all of whom are rehabbing from surgery. We lead the NBA's Eastern Conference literally wire to wire. We are the number one seed in the East. We sweep the first and second rounds of the NBA playoffs. We are the first team in Eastern Conference history to start the playoffs 10-0. Coach Lou becomes the first head coach in NBA history to start his career 10-0 in the postseason, passing Pat Riley, who was 9-0. We win our 17th straight Eastern Conference Finals game in the conference finals, becoming the first team in conference history to do that. We finish off Toronto in 6 games, winning Game 5 by a franchise postseason record 38 points. LeBron and James Jones make their 6th straight NBA Finals appearances, an NBA record for anyone not a Bill Russell Celtic. Along the way, we set NBA playoff records for most consecutive games with 12 or more three-pointers, 8, NBA record 77 three-pointers in 4-game sweep of Atlanta. We are the first team in NBA history to make 15 three-pointers in 4 straight games, and we set the all-time NBA record for threes in a game with 25 in Game 2 versus the Hawks. We enter the NBA Finals with the largest scoring differential in Eastern Conference history, plus 177 points. We win Game 3 by 30 points over a 73-win team, becoming the first team in NBA Finals history to win by 30 after losing by 30 the game prior. So, what does all this mean? It means more than you have ever dared to imagine, but no more than we have always done. No team in NBA history has ever come back from down 3-1 in the NBA Finals. Rather than asking you the cliche, why not us, I would like to offer the following. We have seen NBA history in the making every day here. It's not, why not us? It's, what the expletive else would we do? We love it harder. We love it record setting. You know in your hearts and in your minds we have been the NBA drama kings since we came here. I bet you can, and I'd love for you to add to this historical database. What else speaks to you about the record-setting insanity that has been your Cleveland Cavaliers? Let me be the first to tell you, NBA history has been waiting on us. No one else has done this because we have never been here before. We will become the first because that is all we have ever known how to do. NBA history has chosen us. Don't run. Don't be afraid. Don't be discouraged. We will seize our rightful place in that history. Griffin printed out copies and put one in every player's locker to make sure they saw it when they arrived for practice. That was some letter, owner Dan Gilbert said. I was like, you believe we can win 3 in a row? 2 games at Golden State? They've lost like 2 home games in 2 years. He believed. That rallied us. Gilbert is obsessed with surrounding himself with optimism. He uses it as a foundational principle for building his businesses and hiring people. As a result, his Cavs organization is stocked with people who think this way. But Griffin, a lifelong grinder, isn't really one of them. He's self-deprecating with a good sense of humor, but not a sunny optimist. He's much more of a realist, which serves him well as a basketball executive. But he does have a belief in destiny. When Gilbert had a recurrence of cancer, it was natural to look at it as terrible luck. But Griffin looked at it as fate. Had he not come to the Cavs, he likely wouldn't have been treated at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the finest cancer hospitals in the world. The doctors there healed him and allowed him to keep working. He did truly believe in the concept of things happening for a reason. He saw that in the Cavs team, even if many of Gilbert's employees thought he might have lost it when they read the email. There was, however, a reason for Hope coming. After reviewing the film, the NBA decided that Green had committed a flagrant foul when hitting James between the legs on that play. The league declared, Green made unnecessary contact with a retaliatory swipe of his hand to the groin. The act alone carried a fine and, had it been called during the game, would have resulted in 2 free throws plus possession. But it was the 3rd flagrant foul Green had been assessed in the playoffs. He'd body slammed the Houston Rockets' Michael Beasley, plus the kick to Adams's groin. The 3 together triggered an automatic suspension for the next game. And so with that, Green was suspended for Game 5. The Warriors were incensed, and their fans were equally furious and began a wave of backlash against the decision. It was challenging for the public to understand Green wasn't suspended only for the quick swipe at James alone, but as the culmination of a series of fouls. Shortly after the Cavs had been complaining about officiating, it was now the Warriors' side claiming they'd been wronged. Even Thunder fans were upset. Green's foul on Adams had been more egregious and didn't result in suspension. Technically, the NBA punished Green worse for the Adams kick, a flagrant 2 foul, than for Green's act on James, a flagrant 1. But the nuance was lost in the heat of the reaction. Meanwhile, the Warriors were angry that James hadn't gotten any punishment for his act of stepping over Green, and they mocked him for being offended that Green had called him a bitch in the wake of the move. I don't know how the man feels, but obviously people have feelings, and people's feelings get hurt, even if they're called a bad word, Klay Thompson said. I guess his feelings just got hurt. Thompson said it minutes after learning Green had been suspended, and his disgust was palpable. What the Warriors said about James privately among each other was clearly much worse. I'm not going to comment on what Klay said, because I know where it can go, James said. It's so hard to take the high road. I've been doing it for 13 years. It's so hard to continue to do it, and I'm going to do it again. It did not end there. It quickly spilled into social media. Maurice Spates, a Warriors backup forward, tweeted a picture of a baby's bottle, a clear reference to James's complaining. Then, Ayesha Curry, who had become perhaps the highest-profile spouse in the NBA, wrote on her Twitter account, High road, invisible bridge used to step over said person when open floor is available to the left and right. Again, it wasn't hard to imagine what was being said in the Curry household about James, especially with the feeling a championship was just hours away. The next afternoon, Lou was antsy in his hotel room before it was time to leave for the game. He didn't want to watch ESPN and hear about the series, so he turned on the History Channel and watched a documentary about the Civil War. He couldn't help connecting what he was watching to his team's job that night. It was in his head as he addressed the team before they took the floor. That happened from 1861 to 1865, and we lost a lot of great men, he told them. But the thing that stood out to me was they were just showing how they lined up and they were preparing for war. And the guys on the front line, they knew they were going to die, but they were willing to die for the guys behind them, and they were willing to die and sacrifice for their country. When you're on that front line, you got to be prepared and ready to die. Everybody tonight in this locker room has to be prepared and ready to stand on the front line. Lou was rolling. My grandpa taught me a quote a long time ago that everybody can't walk in the streets. That's why they made sidewalks, he barked to the team. And we got to be the tougher team tonight. We've got to show our toughness. He closed with this. The 2 most important days of your life is when you were born and when you discover the reason why you were born. And I think we were born to be champions. We got a tough road to conquer, but we can do it. We're down 3-1, but we got to have the mindset that when we go into this game tonight, we're going to win. Mark Twain, Love said after hearing the line. It was from Twain, but Lou didn't even know it. He was grabbing at every piece of 19th century motivation he could think of. Players appreciated his sense of calmness. He was always under control on the sidelines and in huddles. It was something he learned playing for Phil Jackson with the Lakers. But behind the scenes, Lou wasn't afraid to get emotional, as he showed that day at the Trump Soho late in the season, and as he would show several times in Oakland in the coming days. The crowd that night was peppered with signs supporting Green. Warriors owner Joe Lacob arrived at his courtside seat in a green jersey, an obvious protest aimed at the NBA officials in the building. Green was barred from the arena, but wanted to be close by. If the Warriors won, there was to be a party. So he attended the Oakland A's game being played next door at O.co Coliseum against the Texas Rangers. He rented a suite so he could watch the game, and if the Warriors won, there was a tunnel connecting the stadium and Oracle Arena that he could use to be on the floor in minutes. Warriors general manager Bob Myers joined Green in the suite, as did Marshawn Lynch, an Oakland native. Hidden in the corner of the arena was staging and graffiti guns for a trophy presentation, which arena officials had practiced that afternoon. Champagne was secretly in a back room being iced, and hundreds of Warriors' family and friends were there, with a party planned after the win. The Warriors were ready. The Cavs were not. Lou made a strategy change, making James the primary ball handler. This had been a seesaw game since the first days of Irving and James playing together back in the fall of 2014. They'd come a long way, but sometimes things worked better when James just played point guard. It worked again, as the change helped free James's and Irving's flow. That, and they played with a newfound determination. Without Green, their best defender, the Warriors weren't able to cover as much ground, and James and Irving repeatedly beat them with drives. James had been averaging 21 shots a game in the series, but he took 18 just in the first half of Game 5. He was not going to go down without a fight. Also, his jumper, which had been on hiatus for much of the season, returned, and he drilled 2 3-pointers. He had 25 points at halftime, and Irving had 18 of his own. But Golden State still looked like too much, as Thompson, backing up his words aimed at James, was even better. Known for his ability to go on white-hot shooting streaks, Thompson was doing it again, as he nailed 6 3-pointers and scored 26 points. The game was tied. Less than 2 minutes into the second half, J.R. Smith drove to the basket and collided with Warriors center Andrew Bogut. Smith fell into Bogut's left knee, and Bogut collapsed, rolling on the ground in pain. The arena went silent. Myers got up from the suite with Green next door and ran to the arena. Bogut wasn't much of a scorer and had been benched the year before in the finals, but he was vitally important as a defender. Without Green, losing Bogut was a huge blow. As Bogut was carried to the locker room, it became clear he had a significant injury and would be lost for the series. The Warriors had gotten used to perfect health. But with Curry still not 100% on his knee, and Green and Bogut gone, they were in unfamiliar territory. The game changed with the mood. The Cavs quickly opened an 11-point lead as James and Irving kept pounding away on the Warriors' diminished defense. Thompson finished with 37 points and Curry with 25, but they were subdued in the second half, combining to go 1 of 9 on three-pointers. The Cavs were never in danger again and cruised to a 15-point win. James and Irving both finished with 41 points, combining to make 9 3-pointers. James added 16 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals, and 3 blocks. It was the first time in finals history teammates had scored 40 points in the same game. It was also the beginning of a fulfillment of 2 prophecies, that James and Irving could become a historic tandem, and what Lynn Merritt and James had talked about a week earlier, that James would need to conjure some heroic games. This was a heroic game. Seeing it reminded Lou of a playoff game when he was an assistant coach with the Boston Celtics in 2012. Trying to close out the Miami Heat at home, the Celtics were crushed by James's 45 points in what had been the finest game of James's career. This one might have been even better. With his Boston days on his mind, Lou made a demand in the locker room. Everyone was asked to fork over $100 to him. The players, the coaches, the support staff, the front office members, and even the owners who were there. Cash was produced. Those who didn't have it borrowed from others. When the gathering was over, there was $5,300 that Lou stuffed into an envelope. They were all like, "Where is the money going?" Lou said. Lou took the cash and walked into the coach's office and got up on the desk. He slid a ceiling panel aside in the dank old building and stuffed the cash inside. "We're going to come back, get our money, and get our trophy for Game 7," he said. It was something Celtics coach Doc Rivers had done back in 2009 after his team lost badly on Christmas Day to the Lakers. Believing the Lakers would make the finals, Rivers challenged his team to return to L.A. 6 months later to get their money back. They did, upsetting James's Cavs on the way, although the Lakers beat them in the finals. History was still against the Cavs. They had pulled to within 3-2, but Green would be back, and the Warriors were still confident, believing the James and Irving explosion had been tied to not having their best defensive player. Golden State won Game 6 in Cleveland to win the title the year before, and they were ready to do so again. They rented out a Morton Steakhouse for their post-game celebration, as they had the year before, and dozens of friends and family flew with the Warriors to Cleveland to prepare for the celebration. As tip-off approached, the bus carrying the Warriors' family to the arena got stuck in traffic. Then, on its way into the underground parking lot where players and families enter, there was another traffic jam. Ayesha Curry was on the delayed bus and believed it was the Cavs keeping them from getting into the building. She tweeted, 10 minutes till game time and the whole team's families are sitting here on a bus. They won't let us in yet. Interesting tactic, though." It was the start of a very frustrating night for both of the Currys. The Cavs' momentum traveled with them from the West Coast. James was a demon, his legs looking fresh, and the strategy of him working at point guard continuing to tear apart the Warriors' defensive schemes, even with Green back. In the first quarter alone, James scored 9 points and handed out 4 assists that led to 9 more. The Cavs were up by 20 after 12 minutes, and the Warriors started to show some fatigue, a result of their thinner bench without Bogut, and perhaps the carryover from playing a grueling 7-game series in the conference finals. During a stretch in the second half, James scored 18 consecutive points as his aggression and speed were too much. He scored 41 points again, with 8 rebounds, 11 assists, 4 steals, and 3 blocks. One of the blocks was on Curry in the fourth quarter. James blocked Curry 5 times in the finals, not counting the menacing dead ball block in Game 3. On this one, James trailed him and didn't buy a pump fake before swatting it out of bounds. He looked down at the much smaller Curry afterward and fired off a stream of curse words meant to further accentuate the act of dominance. James was putting together a performance for the ages, and he didn't pass up the chance to rub it in against his top rival, both in basketball and business. It was somewhat hypocritical, since it was James who had been offended by Green's trash talk, but it was clear he didn't care. Curry scored 30 points, but it was a miserable night for him. He was called for several questionable fouls. With 4 minutes left, he was called for his disqualifying 6th foul on James on a play that looked harmless. Curry was incensed, rightly so, as the foul was not even borderline, and he became so enraged that he took out his mouthpiece and threw it in anger. The plastic smashed Andrew Forbes, the son of Cavs co-owner Nate Forbes, in the chin at his courtside seat. Throwing an object into the crowd is an automatic ejection, and Curry was sent to the locker room, which was meaningless since he'd already fouled out. All he did was miss the end of an eventual 115-101 final. He was later fined $25,000 by the league for the act. "I'm happy he threw his mouthpiece," Warriors coach Steve Kerr said. "He had every right to be upset. He's the MVP of the league. He gets 6 fouls called on him. 3 of them were absolutely ridiculous." That got Kerr fined $25,000, the third coach in four series to be fined for complaining about calls against the Cavs. The Warriors, though, felt like there was something against them. First the green suspension, and now the tight officiating on Curry. It seemed like Lou's complaints worked, so why shouldn't Kerr try to see what $25,000 would buy him in Game 7, which was now going to happen? I've lost all respect. Sorry, this is absolutely rigged for money or ratings. Not sure which. I won't be silent. Just saw it live. Sorry, Ayesha Curry tweeted after the game. It was a touchstone comment for Warriors fans, who felt as if there was a conspiracy after the green suspension. Her target seemed off, though, since the league's payment from TV was fixed, no matter how long the series went. The extra game did mean a lot more money, between $15 and $20 million, but for the Game 7 host Warriors for ticket and arena revenue. She was right about the ratings. They were soaring. She later deleted the tweet and apologized, saying she'd gotten upset because security in the arena had racially profiled her father. It turned out Ayesha's father resembled a man whom NBA security was on the lookout for after he had successfully used fake credentials to access arenas. After he was questioned and his credentials checked, it was ironed out. None of it ruffled the Cavs, who behind James had started to believe it was possible. "This is the highest level of basketball I've ever played in my life," said Irving, who scored 23 points. "I know that Game 7 will be the hardest thing ever." Everything had gone against them the year before, and they could feel the karma of it turning. And they could feel James, who was backing up his words and setting a lead for his organization to follow. "Not many people in the history of sports has said, 'Everyone get on my back, city, state, team, organization, get on my back, and I'm going to carry you. If we win or fail, I'll take the blame, but I'm going to lead you,'" Jefferson said as he marveled at James's accomplishments. He is doing this for his teammates. He is doing this for everyone. Chapter 19. The Block, the Shot, the Stop. The day before Game 7, a van pulled up to the Cavs hotel and a group piled in. This had been arranged by Ty Lue, and he was joined by two of his assistant coaches, James Posey and Mike Longobardi. Rich Paul, LeBron James's agent, came after he heard about the trip, curious about the destination. So did Lue's good friend Chauncey Billups, who was in town covering the series as an analyst for ESPN, along with a couple of team staffers and Lue's cousin, Doodles. The van headed north, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge on one of those sunny and clear days where the bay sparkles and San Francisco becomes one of the most picturesque places in the world. They took Route 101, passing Sausalito and into Marin County and all its chic towns with bay views and high-end shopping promenades. They exited the highway and rolled up to a heavily guarded gate at the front of San Quentin State Prison. It had been a day of tension. There was a light practice in Oakland at the Warriors facility, which sits on top of a parking deck attached to a downtown hotel. There was the fulfillment of media obligations. The worldwide press was salivating because the storylines were delicious. It was either going to be the completion of the greatest season in league history if the Warriors won, or it was going to be the greatest comeback in finals history. Lou wanted to get away and get out of the city. Between games 1 and 2 of the series, he'd taken a mental break by going over to Alcatraz for a few hours. He wasn't in the mood for tourist activities now. Instead, there would be a field trip, an unusual and unexpected one for any person, much less a man about to coach Game 7 of the NBA Finals. One of Lou's financial advisors had a connection to San Quentin's warden. It was not going to be a perfunctory tour of the oldest prison in the state of California, consistently home to the largest death row annual count in the country. After the crew showed their IDs and heard the prison door shut with a thud behind them, a member of the traveling party noticed a sign that read, "Inbounds." This caught his eye, of course, because it is a common basketball term. When he asked the guard for the explanation for the sign, he was informed, "Now you are officially part of the prison." As the group made its way through the premises, they found it to be unsettlingly quiet for a place that housed some 4,000 inmates. "Where's everybody at?" Lou asked. "Right now they're being counted," responded a guard. "What do they do when they're done being counted?" Lou replied. "They come out here," said the guard. "Out here where?" Lou asked again. "With us," the guard said. The group did the math. There were 7 or 8 of them with one security guard, and thousands of prisoners, many of them convicted of heinous crimes such as kidnapping, rape, and murder, were about to be released into the yard where they were taking their tour. And here they thought the most dangerous thing they'd face all weekend was defending Steph Curry in the open court. At that moment, a siren went off signifying the count was finished and the prisoners were free to roam from their cells. The fear the group felt from the seemingly dicey situation quickly subsided. As they were recognized by the prisoners, the feeling turned from sinister to banter. Warriors fans in the yard talked trash. Cavs fans shouted out support. Lakers fans cheered the former backup point guard for the purple and gold. And Lou, naturally, heard about the iconic moment when Allen Iverson stepped over him during the 2001 finals. Billups' credentials as Mr. Big Shot from his championship days with the Detroit Pistons were called out as some prisoners boasted about their jumpers being more accurate. Here Lou was, in the midst of some of the most hardened criminals on the face of the earth, and the game of basketball, just like it had always been, was his guiding compass. He thought about the obvious difference between his lot in life and theirs, and couldn't help but marvel at the moment being shared. It brought to mind a familiar refrain: sports bring everybody together. No matter the race, religion, economic background, or in this case, freedom, sports provide a common language to speak, a common distraction from life's complications. Lou came to the prison looking for an escape from the pressure surrounding the winner-take-all Game 7, and was reminded that the finals, just a series of basketball games after all, were serving as an escape for so many others bound to a bleak existence in jail. Once the trash talk died down, Lou, Billups, and the rest of the group were thanked repeatedly for paying a visit. "Talking hoops was therapeutic," the prisoners said. "Their mere presence brightened their day," they added. When the trip ended and the group made the ride back to San Francisco, Lou's mind was back on Game 7, but the dire consequences attached to it didn't seem quite so significant. Much like he had done before Game 5, Lou addressed the team the next day. But his message wasn't shaped by Mark Twain or the History Channel. It was straight out of San Quentin. "This could have been any one of us," he told the Cavs in his pregame speech. The warden said 80% of the guys in there may not have ever committed another crime, but just had one bad night, one bad car ride, one bad fight or whatever, and you could be in there. And from the environments we come from, it could have been any one of us. You're riding with a friend and he's got drugs on him, or you get in an accident and panic and it's a hit and run, or anything. So we got to take advantage of our opportunities in life. We are in a special place that can bring people together. Don't take it for granted. By the time tip-off came, the Warriors' starting lineup perfectly illustrated Lou's point about just how precarious these chances could be. In its center was Festus Ezeli, Andrew Bogut's backup, for his first start of the postseason. Steve Kerr went small in Game 6 without Bogut and started Draymond Green at center. It didn't work, and Golden State was blown out of the building. A change wasn't surprising, nor was it surprising to see the Cavs score the first points of the game on a dump-off pass in the lane from Kyrie Irving to Tristan Thompson, with Thompson powering right through Azili's chest to give Cleveland a 2-0 lead. For a series that had been decided by an average margin of victory of 19.7 points for the winning team in games 1 through 6, Game 7 finally, mercifully, had the feeling early on that it was going to be a tight one worth watching. And people watched. The game had an average viewership of 30.8 million, making it one of the most watched in the history of the sport. By the fourth quarter, more than 40 million Americans were watching, with millions more around the world tuning in at various times of the day. When Harrison Barnes and Draymond Green hit back-to-back threes to take an 8-4 lead, a duo that scored a combined 8 points in Game 6, Oracle started to shake. But rather than capitalize on that momentum, Klay Thompson airballed a transition three Ezeli was blocked at the rim, and Kevin Love scored a layup after missing a couple of point-blank attempts and getting his own rebound, drawing the score to 8-6 and allowing the Cavs to settle back into the game. By the end of the first quarter, the Cavs were up 23-22. Cleveland was pounding the Warriors on the glass, 16-8, and owning the inside, outscoring Golden State 16-4 in the paint. Meanwhile, the Warriors went 5-for-11 from three, while the Cavs were 0-of-4 from deep. Cleveland got back into the series by playing the same up-tempo pace as Golden State and just doing it better. But Game 7 was regressing back along the NBA's traditional East Coast-West Coast contrasting styles. The second quarter was a disaster for the Cavs. As if making up for his Game 5 suspension all at once, Green exploded for 15 points. He made one three-pointer and another, screaming and waving his arms, in part defiance and part joy. James wasn't guarding him close enough, looking to help Cav defenders elsewhere. He was sluggish and perhaps a bit disrespectful of Green's range. Green hit two more three-pointers, now four in a row. Green, who'd been the GOAT for a few days, threw his shoulders back and shook his head as he sniffed the hero role. The Cavs couldn't match it. Their legs looked shaky, and they missed 9 of the 10 three-pointers they put up in the corner. They only hung on with toughness, extra rebounds, and James and Irving bullying points near the basket and at the foul line. So it was still a one-point game with a little more than 3 minutes remaining before the half. The script was easy to follow for most fans and analysts alike watching it play out. However, there was something Lou saw on the court that was bothering him more than the open shots his team was missing. Late in the second quarter, James came to the bench and Lou approached him. "What's wrong with your body language?" Lou asked. "You got to pick your body language up." James demurred. "I'm good. I'm in a good place." "Well, your body language is not showing that," Lou shot back. "Coach, I'm good," James insisted. Lou was going to leave it at that, but James's inconsistent play continued. It didn't matter to Lou that James was either leading or tied with a teammate for the lead in points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks up to that point in the game. Lou, a former teammate of Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, knew there was more he could give. In the final timeout before halftime, Lou went back to challenging James. Only this time it was in front of the entire team. "Bron, you got to be better," he implored. "If we're going to win, you got to be better." James, again, was incredulous. "What are you talking about?" he said. "What are you talking about?" "You got to be better," Lou repeated. "What do you want me to do?" James asked, clearly perturbed. "I want you to guard Draymond. I want you to shoot your open shots. I want you to be aggressive and stop turning the ball over," Lou rattled off. "Is there anything else?" The speech didn't take, at least at first. James coughed up his fourth turnover of the half. Golden State as a team only had 5, and that led to a Leandro Barbosa 3 and the Warriors' biggest lead of the game, up 47-40 with 2:08 remaining. James added to his first half output a badly missed pull-up 3 that came on an isolation possession before the buzzer sounded. Cleveland trailed 49-42. There were 24 minutes separating either the greatest comeback in finals history or simply more soul-crushing disappointment for both the city of Cleveland and for James personally. James's third consecutive finals defeat was very much in play. When his team got to the locker room, Lou went in on James once again. It was James, by averaging 41 points, 12 rebounds, 9 assists, 3.5 steals, and 3 blocks in games 5 and 6, who had gotten the Cavs this far. It would have to be James to take them all the way. "Bron, you got to be better," Lou said. "You can get mad if you want. You can smack your lips, whatever you want to do, but you got to be better. You're the leader of this team. You got to be better." Next, he turned to Kyrie Irving, who was tied up with Stephen Curry with 9 points apiece. "And Kyrie, I want you to be aggressive, but you got to take better shots," Lou said. "I don't mind your shots, but you got to take better shots. Be aggressive." Lou kept his words short and retreated to the coach's office, giving the players time to ready themselves. James was fuming. One of the team's security guards, who worked with James in both Miami and Cleveland, later told Lou that he had never seen anyone speak to James like that before. First, James found Damon Jones, his former teammate during his first stint with the Cavs, who had joined the team as a special assistant for the playoffs after spending the year working with their D-League affiliate, the Canton Charge. "D. Jones, your boy is on some bullshit," James said. "Who are you talking about?" Jones asked. "What's going on?" "Man, T. Lou, he should never question me," James said. "All the effort I give?" Jones is more than just a former teammate of James's. He is a friend. But he didn't blindly take his friend's side. "Listen, I haven't been here all year, but everything I read, I see on TV, you talk about how Coach Lou is our leader. He's so poised. He gives us confidence. We believe in him," Jones said. "That's all I've seen all year about how much you believe in him and how much you trust him. So why not trust him now?" James was stumped. "Fuck you, man," he said. You right. Fuck you." Still, he needed further affirmation, so he went to another Jones, James Jones, who has been around him forever, making the last 6 trips to the finals with him side by side as a teammate in both Miami and Cleveland. "Man, I can't believe T. Lou would say that," James began. "LeBron, is he lying?" James Jones asked. "No, man, but..." James's voice trailed off. "Well, there's your answer," James Jones said. LeBron James had heard enough. "Fuck y'all," he said, and made his way out of the locker room, back down the tunnel, and onto the court, to prep for the biggest half of basketball of his life. The third quarter started much the way the second quarter ended. As big as this opportunity was for the Cleveland side of things, the Warriors were playing at home, where they went 39-2 during the regular season. And even if Curry looked a level below his unanimous MVP status, they still had Klay Thompson, the guy who got the Warriors to the finals in the first place, with 41 points in Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals against the Oklahoma City Thunder, as Golden State was on its way to its own comeback from a 3-1 series deficit. The Cavs quickly cut the Warriors' lead to 3, but Thompson scored 5 straight points on a long pull-up 3 and a fadeaway jumper over Love to increase the cushion back to 8. With Curry slogging through yet another off-shooting night, on his way to failing to connect on better than 40% of his shot attempts for the 4th time in the series, Thompson seemed like he would be able to carry the added weight. The scoreboard read 54-46 in favor of the Warriors after the flurry. In the bowels of the arena in a hidden corner, a bin of champagne bottles now on ice with reams of plastic and tarps that would be used to seal the lockers and floors to protect the winning locker room from damage, waited for guidance. It was positioned between the locker rooms, and at this point, it looked like it was headed down the carpeted hallway toward the home team, and not the bland concrete path to the visitor's room. But in the next 100 seconds, the score was suddenly tied, thanks to Irving and the man his teammates called Swish. J.R. Smith, the Cleveland wild card, had been maligned for wilting on the finals stage a year ago. With the stakes at their highest, he got the Cavs back in it, canning 3s on consecutive possessions. Irving added a layup, blowing by the much slower Azili. Whether it was Lou's halftime speech that did it this time around or not, the Cavs were a different team when staring at elimination. James came out in the third quarter after Lou's direct challenge and put up 5 assists against 0 turnovers. After getting a green light from his coach, Irving scored 12 third-quarter points, more than Curry's and Thompson's 10 points combined in the period. The Cavs regained control of the game, building a 7-point margin of their own before the Warriors rallied to take back the lead heading into the fourth quarter, 76-75. At this point, the magnitude spiked tenfold. This wasn't just the culmination of a long season or 12 months building toward a finals rematch. Because of the stakes and the size of the audience, what was happening in these minutes was career-defining. These would be the events that would adorn walls, run endlessly on highlight shows, and perhaps create nightmares. With so much intensity, pressure, and even fatigue, separation between the teams was impossible. The Cavs and Warriors traded baskets as the seconds and then the minutes ticked off the clock. Golden State pushed ahead by 4 just past the halfway point of the period, but James responded with 6 straight points. The Warriors immediately tied it with a Thompson basket. Through nearly 333 minutes played in the finals, the cumulative score between Cleveland and Golden State was 699-699. The first to 700 would end up winning it all. And